This is an ABC podcast.
Our infrastructure is not ready for it. There's flu right now. If the hospital is flu, they cannot admit patients. So we have all these social issues that we cannot even handle. And what makes us think that we can handle even more?
Palau citizens raising concerns about the US sending third country nationals to the Pacific nation. Now, Tonga's only domestic airline has once again grounded, causing frustration for locals and tourists.
This situation could have been averted, avoided, solved far before this has come to fruition. Guests who have travelled from Germany, saved up for a year to come to the Kingdom of Tonga, they are furious. They will not be coming to Tonga again.
And though the First Nations Pacifica 15 team lost to British and Irish Lions last night, what a game. We'll have more on that later in the show. But firstly, morena, no ia e Māori and aloha kākou. I'm your host, Aggie Dubow, and this is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. We acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I say ngā mihi. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, a draft agreement between the US and Palau to send third country nationals to the Pacific nation is raising alarm bells. As Jordan Fennell reports, there are concerns about the strain it would put on the small country and whether it can say no to the deal.
When Palauan radio show host Jennifer Sugiyama first heard about the draft proposal, she was shocked.
What makes USA think Palau can accommodate refugees since it lacks the resources and funds? We have seen a lot of negative feedback from it. And we have issues. We all have issues in our own country.
Under the draft agreement, the U.S. will transfer people who are seeking protection against returning to their home countries to Palau while their protection claims are processed. The small Pacific nation has a population of almost 18,000 people, and Jennifer believes that if Palau were to agree to this, it would put a huge strain on the country's resources.
Our infrastructure is not ready for it. There's flu right now. If the hospital is flu, they cannot admit patients. So we have all these social issues that we cannot even handle, and what makes us think that we can handle even more?
At a press conference, Palau's President Soronga Whipps Jr. said the draft isn't final and is subject to further discussion.
So there's a request from America that we have received. There are discussions about it with the US. The US says there are 1.5 million people in the US claiming they seek asylum. So the first request is, Palau, would you consider the request? And if we possibly consider, then further discussions will take place.
US President Donald Trump has made deporting undocumented migrants from America a top priority of his second term in office. It's unclear what status these third country nationals who might be transferred to Palau fall under, but Associate Professor Jose Sousa Santos from the University of Canterbury's Pacific Regional Security Hub says the vague language is a big cause for concern.
It's quite a broad term, people seeking protection in the United States, and that could be illegal migrants, and it could be asylum seekers. And the difference here is asylum seekers do have protection under the international law. Immigrants don't.
The draft proposal says the US will follow its international obligations under the United Nations Refugee Convention. But Palau is not a signatory to that document. Instead, it says Palau would act according to its constitution, which expressly prohibits torture, cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment or punishment. Danielle Watson, an associate professor at the Queensland University of Technology's School of Justice, says Palau would need to reform its laws to process asylum claims.
Palau may need to establish or enhance their own national legislation and administrative mechanisms to be able to process asylum claims in line with international standards. And at present, Palau lacks a comprehensive legal framework for refugee status determination.
Palau is one of three Pacific nations that has a Compact of Free Association, or COFA, deal with the United States, providing them with billions of dollars in financial support in exchange for U.S. military access to their territories. The draft proposal doesn't say whether Palau would get anything in return for agreeing to it. But the University of Canterbury's Jose Sousa Santos says the COFA arrangement puts Palau in a hard place to say no to it.
The undue control that it has over its budget and over the COFA states' budgets does put Palau and other COFA states, such as the Federated States of Micronesia and the Marshall Islands, in a hard place to say no or to try to get a better deal whilst negotiating with the US.
And that was Associate Professor at the University of Canterbury's Pacific Regional Security Hub, Jose Sousa Santos, speaking there to reporter Jordan Fennell. And Pacific Beat has reached out to Palau's government for comment.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys. Join us for Stories from the Pacific, Wednesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or where you get your podcasts.
Minaka and welcome back to Pacific Beat. To Fiji now, where the forum trade ministers gathered to confront the challenges shaping the trade and economic development in the region. Pacific Islands Forum Secretary General Baron Wonga says rising protectionism, trade wars, climate shocks and geopolitical instability are threatening already vulnerable Pacific economies. Speaking at a press conference, one area that was highlighted by Mr. Wonga was the ongoing development of the Pacific Labour Mobility Principles.
The ministers did discuss the labour mobility as far as providing economic benefit to those that are involved in the arrangements, especially with Australia. It not only provides economic benefit to Australia, but those who are engaged within that setup. As you know, the whole of the Pacific has been encouraged to take part, and the discussion was just around how each of the countries can benefit, and not so much the some of the negative aspects of losing skilled and talented workers to the bigger countries like Australia, mainly because trade ministers were more concerned about the free trade arrangement between those big countries and our island countries providing the labour.
And that's Pacific Islands Forum Secretary General Baron Wonga. Now, domestic air travel in Tonga is at a standstill after serious safety concerns grounded the country's only domestic airline, Lurutai. The Civil Aviation Division announced the suspension on Saturday, leaving dozens of tourists and local passengers stranded in the middle of Tonga's peak tourism season. And despite assurances from the Aviation Authority that it is acting with safety in mind, tourism operators are furious. Tonga reporter Marion Kupel has the story.
For New Zealand tourist Lisa Harrington, the announcement came as a shock.
We'd planned to be here a week, so we're due to fly out tomorrow. We learnt yesterday morning that the airline wasn't running.
The 50-year-old from Auckland is stranded in Hapai in Tonga's northeast with her partner. Now, with the country's only domestic airline grounded, they've been forced to change their international flights and book a ferry in order to get home.
I believe it's a 10 to 12 hour trip. I'm not sure what it is, whether it's a cargo ferry or an animal ferry or what it is, but we're on that. Obviously, we are able to get out, but not the experience we wanted. I mean, it cost us $1,000 to change our flights with Air New Zealand for two people. There's an additional two nights accommodation. I think it's going to be a good $2,500 to $3,000 it's going to cost me, plus 2 days off work.
In what Tonga Civil Aviation Division described as a rare decision, it grounded the government-run airline Lulutai on Saturday after non-compliance in three areas.
So firstly, we found non-compliance with Civil Aviation Rule Parts 145 with relation to the hangar and facilities, and also with personnel, and also with tools and equipment. In terms of about the Lulutai's performance, we found out that work wasn't done in an approved area, location. That was why it was suspended.
That was Tonga's Civil Aviation Division Director, Vinolia Fifitasalesi. She says the decision was not taken lightly, but the company was well aware of the requirements they need to comply.
Traveling public's safety is paramount. I would like to apologize to all the stranded passengers.
The airline suspension will remain in place until July the 27th, or earlier if all non-compliance is addressed. But the ripple effects are already being felt across the tourism sector. Jason Strickland, a hotel manager in Tongatapu, says the situation could have been avoided.
I think Tonga's so small, we all know what each other had for breakfast. This situation could have been averted, avoided, solved far before this has come to fruition.
And he says the damage to Tonga's reputation may be lasting.
Guests who have travelled from Germany, saved up for a year to come to the Kingdom of Tonga, have no answers. They are furious. They will not be coming to Tonga again, and they certainly won't be recommending it.
Lulu Tai and the minister responsible for the airline have both been contacted for comment. In a statement on social media, Lulu Tai did not mention the safety concerns, instead saying the flight cancellation were due to an unforeseen circumstances. But the latest incident is not isolated, with Lulu Tai forced to ground its main aircraft last year after it collided with a cement block on a runway. The airline is also facing financial pressures, with reports circulating earlier this year that it may be close to collapse. Back on Hapai, Lisa Harrington says she will never return to the kingdom, despite being a regular visitor.
No, I'm not coming back to Tonga. Yeah, I'm being genuinely honest with that. I do not want to get on an aeroplane that has had this reputation in the past.
And that was New Zealand tourist Lisa Harrington, ending that report from Marin Kupu in Tonga. Kia rana and welcome back to Pacific Beat. It is that time we head around the region, of course, getting our latest headlines from the Pacific, and that's brought to you by our producer, Carl Evans. Joining me in the studio this morning, we've made it to Wednesday. How are you doing?
Good morning, Aggie. I'm well. It's been a busy week so far, and halfway there.
It is. And, of course, there is a lot that is happening out in the region. This one here, really concerning, is PNG's NRL franchise board director has spoken out amid corruption concerns. Well, what's he had to say?
He's not a happy camper, Aggie. So Wapu Sonk has lashed out at what he's described as incorrect and defamatory allegations over a corruption investigation into his business dealings. So he issued the statement a couple of days ago after standing down from his position as chair of that new PNG NRL franchise board. And he did that after the Nine newspapers in Australia alleged he may have attempted to financially benefit from a deal between the country's national oil and gas company and a Chinese government-controlled firm. However, he's declared those reports were based on false information and falsified documents, and he said he only stepped aside from the PNG Rugby League board to protect the new franchise. In the meantime, he says the matter has been referred to the police, and he's instructed his lawyers in Australia to study the media statements and prepare a defamatory case.
That's a big one. Okay, well, we head to Papua New Guinea, though. The nature park in Port Moresby, they have successfully bred the country's national bird, which is the Cornwall. You have to tell us more.
Yeah, that's right. So the Raggiana Bird of Paradise, as it's more commonly known by, it's actually the second time they've bred the bird successfully in the last 4 years. So from what I understand, it's one of the more complicated birds to breed. There's a bit of a process involved, a bit like the panda. I don't know if you've got to get them in the mood or something, but yep. And for instance, I know for one, they actually need incubators to put their eggs in because the animals they tend to coexist in the same living area and often destroy each other's eggs. And they are an endangered bird too. I know they've been hunted for their feathers in the past, so this program is one of many they have to protect endangered animals within the nature park. And obviously, look, initiatives like this, they're important going forward, particularly with this particular bird, who's I think is probably going to become a bigger symbol in the company, within the country as the PNG NRL and our RL team gets closer to fruition, and a bigger spotlight is put on the national team, the Kumuls.
All right, so it's the Kumul bird. Okay, well, we'll keep an eye on that story. In sport, though, Flying Fijians head coach Mick Byrne, he's head out at World Rugby ahead of the Pacific Nations Cup next month. What's happened there?
Yeah, so it's mainly around cost and preparation time that he's not happy with, and how that unfairly impacts Pacific teams. So Fiji, Samoa, and Tonga and Samoa have the majority of their players based in Europe this time of year. So he says it's very hard for them to basically get ahead and prepare for these international tournaments with so many players. Of their players based so far away in the Northern Hemisphere. Fiji, for instance, only had a week to prepare for their Wallabies encounter, and after the Scotland game, virtually all of them have since dispersed back to their clubs across places like the UK and France. However, they'll have to get together again for the Pacific Nations Cup next month for their clash with Tonga on the 30th. They'll probably only have about 2 weeks of preparation time for that game. So it's just a lot of travel in quite a small time frame, and it's obviously very costly for the players just to fly that much. And it's also a very small window of preparation time to actually play the game. Obviously, that has an impact on performance. And usually for most other teams in the world, they'll usually get about a 6 week preparation window. So basically he's calling for, World Rugby to level the playing field a little bit, because if you look at other, bigger countries on this part of the world, like Australia and New Zealand, these aren't issues that they have to face. That's given right. Most of their players will play locally. So it's very easy for them to get together on short notice. Well, easier, I should say. So yeah, he wants to see some changes made.
I think that's not a hard ask.
That's fair enough.
A level playing field. I think that's a goal for our Pacific people to just be extended the same as the rest of the other countries that are playing. But look, as always, Kyle, great to have you on the program to bring us our headlines. That is our producer, Kyle Evans, with our headlines for your news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
Join me, Melissa Makin, for Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference. Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday from 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Me taki ma'ata. Thank you for joining us here on Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Dubol. Talking about sport, this is the British and Irish Lions, who survived a near upset loss against the First Nations Pasifika team in Melbourne last night, winning by 24 points to 19. The hastily put together First Nations Pasifika were the underdogs, and most had expected a walkover win for the Lions, who only last week defeated the Wallabies. But the First Nations Pasifika had other plans. Whenau Whanua attended the match and filed this report.
Well, they want the score. They're going to get the score. Rob Leota.
It was a near disaster for the British and Irish Lions in what many thought would be an easy warm-up session. The Lions headed into the game off the back of a month of lopsided victories against all of the Australian Super Rugby teams, in addition to a win over the Wallabies just last week. First Nations Pasifika had only 1 week to prepare for the game, a fact that's gobsmacked rugby commentators, and the British and Irish fans are not happy.
They found it quite difficult. There's a lot of errors.
We need to get rid of that Van der Meer. We need to take him off.
We're building for the weekend, so that's the aim now, just get to the second test and win that.
I think the game was very stressing because sometimes the Pasifika would take the ball and it was really, really stressing. But I enjoyed the match.
Yeah, it's not falling away there. That's a good
start. The game initially looked like it would be another easy victory for the Lions after they scored two tries within the opening 11 minutes.
Again, it's that ball out to Darcy Graham, who's off and scuttling into the corner and round towards the post. Muirhead can't do anything about it. He's got the try.
But Pasifika First Nations hit back with two tries of their own, the first off an intercept by Waratahs winger and Dunguti man Tristan Riley in the 18th minute.
It's King Horn, and that's risky, too risky. Taken by Riley, who's now got a whole lot better.
The second try came 5 minutes later when Fiji-born Reds flanker Seruuru crashed over the line from 2 metres out.
Here it comes, and it is the try.
The second half emulated the first, with Lions scoring two quick tries to give them a comfortable 24-14 lead. But a try in the 71st minute by Waratahs' number 8 Rob Leota narrowed the score down to 24-19, and only one more try was needed to seal a victory, but the Lions held out.
Well, they keep on winning on Australian soil, but that was tight, that was squeaky.
Unbelievably proud. We talked before the game, all week actually, about a performance.
In a post-game presser, First Nations Pacifica coach Dotai Gefu and assistant Kirtley Bio said despite the team only having a week to train, shared cultural values brought cohesion and unity.
We find connecting is very easy for us, so we build on that.
I'm thinking bigger picture here. I think for the next generation, the young kid, the young Pacifica First Nations kids in Australia, paving the pathway, I think this jersey, this emblem, represents them.
First Nations and Pacifica players Seru Uru, Rob Leota and Charlie Gambo told journalists the game was never about winning, but representing their culture and family.
We're standing on the shoulders of giants in terms of our ancestors and our families.
Yeah, it's the first time for us to be able to represent First Nations and Pacifica, and such a special thing for our culture and represent our families. I was saying, like, all the different journeys and the way we've been growing up. It's actually funny because it's all very similar. Like, we've all gone through the same struggles. Everything our parents have done to, you know, put ourselves in a good position in life. And, like, to be able to pay them back like this and represent our cultures and our families is pretty cool.
And that was First Nations Pacifica flanker Charlie Gamble. Pacific Beat. Well, first, it was a group of Papua New Guinea's top cricketers who were asking whatever happened to their promised prize money after competing in the T20 World Cup. Now it's the turn of the national men's soccer team, with their all-time top goal scorer, Raymond Ganimba, wanting to know why payments due after the couples won the MSG Prime Minister's Cup last year have still not been made. It's an all-too-familiar story, but maybe things will change now that Papua New Guinea footballer have a voice inside the world ruling body. In a first for the Pacific, the couple's captain, Arwin Gomalong, has been accepted onto the FIFA Player Executive Programme, and his selection is already making a difference.
What I tell the FIFA guys is, before, it didn't really feel like FIFA was paying any attention really to the region or players for that matter. And now you truly get a sense that they're making a concerted effort to involve players more in the transition to executive spaces and having more input from the players. And for football in the region, it's massive. I'm already trying to see if I can get more players from the region onto the future editions of the program, because the people you meet, the world is your oyster now. You have friends in Mexico, in Peru, in Singapore, in Europe, and being part of the global FIFA family is the true value in it. And you have an issue, you can just pick up the phone and call someone in South America or Europe, and it's almost free advice.
Do you get the sense, or in fact, do you know that being involved with this executive program, because you're playing the game, could perhaps open doors for Papua New Guinea and maybe Oceania as a whole that football officials are not able to open?
100%. The network you have also have their network. So I could even invite one of the big time players to come over, because we're now friends from the program. You know, they've expressed that kind of interest to come and see the place. How we go about it is another story, but that's just an example. And not just that, in the opportunities in maybe sending players abroad or creating programs that can be driven by the presence of some well-known figures in the game that can inspire some kids. The opportunities are endless in that sense.
And where do you see this taking you currently? You're still very much a player. You're captain of the national side. But looking ahead a bit further, are you looking at being involved in FIFA on a professional scale, as it were? Are you even looking at the possibility you might be involved in running the game in Papua New Guinea one day?
Yeah, one day maybe, but not immediately. I still have a lot of personal goals that I want to tick off. But certainly down the line, it's something to consider. But I can't really look too far into the future, because there are other opportunities out there, and it would ultimately come down to what is best best for me, my family, and the career and objectives that I want to achieve.
And as far as the national side is concerned, at the moment, the PNGFA seems to have a bit of a problem holding on to a coach. They've lost two in recent times. Yeah. Felipe Vega Oango has left apparently for personal reasons, and prior to that, Warren Moon left over a contractual dispute, which I think is still going on. That doesn't help, does it?
Correct. I think the important thing is to have someone that has some stability and that is well supported. That's something we haven't had in the last couple of years. And you could see that we were building towards something with the Prime Minister's Cup win. I think that performance was everything that we had been working on throughout the year. So it was good to see it come to fruition and have some success from it. But with the changing of a coach again, there's a lot of questions in the air, programs and what happens next. That's something, again, we don't know. But at the same time, we all have to get on with our lives. And that's sort of what I'm doing at the moment. I'm not holding my breath on what's happening on that front, even though I will support the team no matter what. And we just hope for the best outcome.
Could your connections with FIFA newly established be of assistance in helping the PNGFA find a coach who might actually stick around?
I wish it could at this moment. I think I'm still a bit of a greenhorn in that sense in the FIFA space. But I think in the future, it could definitely lead to something. I think the FA has a lot of work to do on themselves and I'm doing my bit on another front. But at some point, I could definitely see my connections or my side of the work that I'm doing also being of benefit to the FA. And I'm hoping at some point that we could maybe collaborate on that.
And just a word on player payments, a subject which has come up again. Your former international teammate Raymond Gonumba has gone public saying that players who won the Prime Minister's Cup last year have not received the payments that they were due at the time, and Papua New Guinea is hosting the tournament this year, so clearly not a good look. My sense is that you've campaigned on this long and hard often enough that maybe you've reached the point where there's not enough walls left for you to bang your head on.
Yeah, correct. My situation is different maybe to other players, but at the heart of it, you know, I'm their captain and I'm their leader. And it's sad to see what it's come to. You know, certain promises were made and those promises haven't been fulfilled. But an important thing that I think from the messaging that I have to make clear is that I don't want this issue to be misconstrued as players being motivated by money to play for the national team. And that has never been the case wherever we've gone and whatever success we have. I think you would also appreciate and understand that when we do play, we're not standing on the pitch when that whistle blows thinking, oh, we might get paid after this game or not. We're purely playing for our country. We're not motivated by money. But for many players in Papua New Guinea, football is the main source of income. And when certain promises are made, people commit time and effort and away from their families, they should be justly compensated for that. Unfortunately, the sports industry in PNG is not really well set up and there aren't really any processes or protocols in place that would maybe be a voice for the players in terms of reaching agreements with the authorities, and whether it be Sports Foundation or the FA, but it's something that I think we should be working on. There should be more of a concerted effort towards creating maybe collective bargaining agreements, some standard set of rules, but it's an unfortunate situation. And as you said, I mean, I've been through it long enough to understand how these conversations go and how long they take and how energy and time consuming they can be. So I've sort of taken a back seat on it. But Raymond's doing the right thing in raising the issue. It's something that has to be put out into the public forum to be discussed. And, you know, with the upcoming tournament, you can imagine players may not have the same level of commitment because certain promises were made. We'll see what happens.
And that was Arwen Komalong, captain of the PNG Couples, talking to Richard Hewitt. And as well, joining the Player Executive Program, Arwen has also been accepted on the FIFA Master Program, which includes a year-long sabbatical in Europe.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Mum, can I get these pair of shoes? Dad, I need some money for some games. Mum, I need a new phone. That's right, the list can go on. And if you're a parent, those following phrases are all too common. But at what age is it time to stop financially supporting your children? Is this a view we entertain across the Pacific, or is this a Western concept? And how does the term "it takes a village to raise a child" play into all of this? Well, to help us answer some of these questions, we're joined by our guest from Aotearoa New Zealand, researcher, teaching assistant, doctoral candidate at the School of Economics and Finance at Massey Business School, Vika Namo. Then I say, Malo tau mai bongbongini, Vika, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Malo Alberto, Aggie, and thank you for the opportunity to talk on this important topic this morning.
Yeah, absolutely. I do probably want to start with that term, you know, it takes a village to raise a child, which we know for Pacific people, you know, is that even a good starting point when viewing how we raise or even teach our children about money and finances?
Definitely. That's a good starting point, Aggie. And, you know, let me start by saying You know, in our Pacific families, this is a common a phrase used to sort of raise our children. But to me personally, it takes a village to raise a child. But it's not just about, you know, the financial contribution that, you know, that that we focus on. I guess the phrase is all about, you know, it also has a non-financial contribution side to it that shapes our, you know, our children, such as, you know, love, you know, our guidance and cultural knowledge and just the opportunity for self-growth. These are the things that truly add long-term value to, you know, our young children's lives. And so financial support has its place to a certain point, but it should not also come at the cost, you know, of our parents' own well-being or long-term financial security.
Mm. Well, Vika, the thing is, you know, this story actually stemmed from an article that was released. And, you know, I was really interested in trying to figure out, you know, what does this look like through a Pacific lens? And so I'm wondering whether or not you actually have, stats for, the Pacific region or even the Pacific diaspora. Do you have numbers in the work that you do in regards to how we handle money or finances?
At the moment, again, no. I'm currently more leaning towards sort of a financial education workspace. Mm. But, I mean, I can also comment on it because with our Pacific people, I don't have children on my own, but from my experience as a researcher, I've also done some financial mentoring work, which has exposed me to a wide range of real life cases, you know, where we have, it's given me the confidence to actually contribute meaning fully to this discussion, because I've seen Pacific parents come in, they're in big debt because they often, you know, sort of ignore the fact that, you know, that they're supporting their financially supporting their child, not knowing, you know, the consequences behind it, but often, you know, they view it as their duty. But there is an extent to, you know, to fulfilling your duties, to financially supporting your child.
Yeah. And look, I can only share from, you know, my lived experiences, possibly even yours, Vika. Mm-hmm. We have this view, right, that kids can stay at home forever, right? There's even that preference, mm-hmm. even after you get married, that your child could still stay at home, right? And then there's that yep. support. So I'm wondering, that whole Pacific view versus maybe a Western view, is that, do you find that with our Pacific children or Pacific parents that it is hard to let go of our children and let them go be independent?
Yeah, definitely. And I can comment on that, Aggie, because it's often happening. It's happening now in my own family. And, you know, growing up, I've always, you know, I'm as a Pacific person, I've often observed and personally experienced that the deep sense of responsibility that my parents feel to continue providing our financial support and well into, you know, to my adulthood. And, you know, I remember saying to my father, if I could get, you know, during my high school years, because I had a non-Pacific friends who were already working part-time to cover, you know, their personal expenses and bills. And I would always, I remember coming home after school and asking my father if I'm allowed to, you know, to work at with my friends so that I could earn some money. But his, you know, his response was quite firm. You know, you're not allowed to work until you finish your studies. And this is, you know, a typical expression of a Tongan father's wisdom. And I guess, I mean, I'm still living at home, but I do know the boundaries between when to stop, you know, sort of freeloading off my parents. but that's definitely the feeling that, you know, our parents tend to have, which is different from, you know, a Western perspective, which, you know, they typically emphasize individualism and personal responsibility. And I've seen it. It's quite evident in the work that we do when we ask parents, oh, okay, so how do you sort of, you know, support your child? So we're looking at, you know, last year we did a project in teaching financial education to young diverse learners. And so teaching, you know, the way that they teach financial literacy to their kids, it's different to how we Pacific people teach our children and how to, you know, to be financially independent.
Well, and that leads me to my question, to extend a little bit on that financial literacy thing. Are we as specific people afraid to have these conversations with our kids, you know, around money, or do we just leave this to the likes of school and education?
Yeah, that's definitely a good question, Aggie. And I guess, you know, it's such an awkward topic, and I can speak on that because it's happening in my family. I'm often asking because I'm at home living with, you know, just your typical Pacific family with my three siblings. And so, you know, often we're all quite adult children. And I often hear one of them asking my father for, you know, for money. She works full time. And so I'm asking my father, you know, why aren't you teaching, you know, or you could say, it's not to say you're not, you know, you're not providing the support for your family, but for your child. But you know, I often tell him, though that the subject is awkward, but, you know, teaching financial literacy to our children is not just for their benefit, but it's a long-term well-being. You know, I often say to Pacific when I'm out doing delivering workshops that if you continue to, you know, financially support your children well into their adulthood, because, you know, we know that it's our cultural values of love and duty, but it's going to place ongoing financial pressure on you as a parent, especially now that, you know, today's high cost of a living is rising, and we can't afford to do it. And it's very evident in the work that we do as financial mentors as well.
Yeah.
But, and so I usually ask, you know, sort of emphasize to parents, you know, teach your children even as young as you know, 5-year-old, once they understand how to earn money, and it's important to teach budget, to save, and, you know, set financial goals, because this is sort of like the bridging to, you know, financial independence sooner rather than later.
Well then, yeah, Vika, let's talk about that. When do children, you know, start chipping in? Does it change when they do get a job?
For me personally, and from I try and say that, you know, this is not a Western view, but for parents to stop financially supporting your child, I think the best time is when your child secures a full time employment and are able to meet, you know, their basic living needs. This is the best and the most appropriate time for parents to begin reducing or, you know, withdrawing that financial support. Because, you know, this transition often occurs, you know, when, you know, young adults obtain their first full-time job and then begin living independently, which is considered, you know, financially self-sufficient when they're able to cover all expenses. So parents do sort of need to pay attention to that.
Well, yeah, look, I understand there's definitely challenges that our parents would face. And we know that it's not always financial, right? You know, because children can help around home. It's all about, like you said earlier, spending time with family, you know, sharing love and all of that stuff. But the big question that everyone, I'm sure, is wanting to hear an answer to is, when then is it time to stop financially supporting your children?
Yeah. Like I mentioned before, Aggie, I think the best time, and we've seen this through some of the work that we've done, is, you know, if your adult child is earning and can contribute and meet their basic, you know, financial needs, then that's when you sort of need to sort of lay off. I know it's a hard thing to do, but at the same time, you know, our parents are also aging, and it's important that you sort of practice that. I get it that a student is obviously not financially stable, but yeah, for many Pacific parents, they continue to sort of navigate that delicate between, you know, the two cultural frameworks. But it's also important that, you know, they're finding themselves straddling both worlds. But yeah, they need to sort of let go. Once you see your child as once you start seeing your child in their full independence life, secured a full-time job, and also meeting their basic needs, that's actually the perfect time to start letting go and, you know, transitioning and teaching them how to sort of financially grow in independence.
Well, that's probably a conversation I'll probably have to have with my adult child too. So it's some good advice there, Vika. Look, that's all the time we have for this morning. But look, we really appreciate you coming through and having this talano with us. Malo apito.
Thank you again for the opportunity, Eki. Malo apito.
No worries. And that, of course, is researcher, teaching assistant, doctoral candidate at the School of Economics and Finance at Massey Business School, Vika Namoa, here on Pacific Beat.
Join me, Natasha Metten, for Sisters Let's Talk. I'll be interviewing incredible guests and discussing issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
She was just going on to 19 when she had a baby. I instantly blamed myself.
I had to take pictures of some pollution and all that, and I was attacked on board out at sea.
Tune in to Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Hello, and get the one talk. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. We head back to PNG, where a medical doctor has urged Papua New Guineans to look at following family planning methods to limit the number of children they may have due to social and economic challenges that many families are facing. Professor Glenn Moeller, head of the School of Medicine and Health Sciences at the University of PNG, made this comment this week, saying family planning is the way to go and other health awareness information must be given to people about the consequences of having too many children. The population of PNG is said to be well over 10 million, although the correct number is not known. Dr. Mary Bagita is a paediatrician and gynaecologist with the Port Moresby General Hospital, and she told Caroline Tierman she fully supports Professor Moeller's statement.
I think that's a very sensible and responsible statement that he has made, and also it should be really taken into consideration by parents-to-be or parents who have only one or two children, to think about having the number of children one should have. It's better to plan in advance before you have the children, to plan how many children one can look after and afford and raise so that the children are happy and well-rounded. Yeah, so I believe it's a very responsible, a really good statement, and it should be taken seriously by parents to be, young people who in the future will be parents, some of them, and parents who already have children. It's a good conversation to have with your children, your grandchildren, and just everyone around. It really should be a talking point, considering the circumstances, the economic situation that we're in at the moment.
Dr. Mary, what are the consequences of having too many children?
I think the consequences we can look at from many aspects. We can look at it from the medical point of view. Obviously, having too many children is a risk for mothers, the risk of heavy bleeding because now your womb is not functioning as effectively as it did when you first had the first child. So there are medical problems related to that. We have high risk of dying if women are having too many children. And when a mother dies, obviously she's leaving behind a child or children that don't have a mother. So we do like encourage women when they come that dying is a big risk and we don't want mothers to die and leave children without a mother. And then you have to look at the socioeconomic side of having too many children, you know, like lots of children, not enough finances and support to feed, clothe, nourish, educate the children, and then all the social problems that stem from the inability to raise our children properly. So I think I'll probably leave it at that. There's so many social problems, economic problems, apart from the medical problems with having too many children.
What about the financial side of things with having too many children?
Financially, when children are babies, it's sort of easier to look after babies in terms of finances, that they don't really need that much intake, you know, so just breastfeeding, maybe meals, that kind of thing. But when they get older, they need, you know, different food. They need to be educated when they grow of age. They need clothes. They need all sorts of things. So financially, you know, apart from making sure your children are financially adequate and being raised properly, we have to think about financially looking after the parents as well. You have too many children, you'll be worrying about making sure your kids have enough to eat and enough, you know, to be clothed and all that. But the parents themselves also need the same things as the children. So in this economic situation that we're in now, the prices of goods have gone so high. It's really challenging at the moment. You just go into the shops and the prices of food, the prices of basic items is just so high. So something to really consider.
Dr. Mary Bagita, now in PNG, people in those years gone by had land to fall back on, but this is no longer the case these days, is it?
Yeah, that's correct, Caroline. At the moment, our PNG population is probably hovering around 10 million plus. And this is in comparison to what, 30 years ago. Now, population has more than doubled. It's probably tripled in the last almost 30 years. So, obviously, our land mass is also decreasing because of our high population. So it's an issue, and in PNG, especially when we have also tribal fighting in other provinces, we have land conflicts in other provinces, we even have land disputes here in the nation's capital. There's so many land issues. We know from our Melanesian culture that land is really important in our cultures, but the more children we have, the less each person, you know, it is entitled to land. And of course, those who don't have land are looking for land. Yeah, multiple issues, and land is an important issue. We don't have enough of it to go around with all our people.
And that's Dr. Mary Bagita, paediatrician and gynaecologist with the Port Moresby General Hospital in PNG. And she was speaking there with Caroline Terriman.
Do you want to know how to take better care of yourself, whether it's your body or your mind? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has the answers. Pacific Pulse brings together experts, movers and shakers, and the wise aunties and uncles from across the Pacific to break down our health challenges, from how we care for our bodies to the health impacts of culture and island living. Join host Melissa Macon for Pacific Pulse Wednesdays at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Recapping our top story, there's fear the small country of Palau will be put under strain following a draft agreement with the US to allow them to send third country nationals to the Pacific nation.
Our infrastructure is not ready for it. There's flu right now. If the hospital is flu, they cannot admit patients. So we have all these social issues that we cannot even handle. And what makes us think that we can handle even more?
And that's Palawan Radio Show host Jennifer Sugiyama speaking there. Find those stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time, but you can always hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. So until next time, Otoa Avato, this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.
Radio, phone and streaming online. This is ABC Radio Australia.
Yours in the Pacific.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal thug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.